Thank you. Strange to be sitting in this side of the fence, but glad to have you all. I wonder, in terms of, for those of you who don't know, we're going to be televised today, so at some point I'd like us to introduce ourselves. But first things, let's do business. Let's look at the minutes, please. Can I entertain a motion to accept the minutes? Second? Okay. All in favor? Any opposed? So moved. I'm looking to see. Oh, we do. Dr. Frick, nice to meet you. So we do have a new member of the commission, and I'm assuming this is a Dr. Hedley Frick. Indeed. Welcome. From Senator Williams, and glad to have you. And while we are introducing ourselves to the TV, I thought it would be wise and helpful to you to understand who is here. So if we could start around the room, please, beginning with Dr. Choi, and tell us who you are and who you are representing. Is that the right grammar?
Yes, that is. So Moon Choi, I serve as the provost at the University of Connecticut, and we're very excited to be here.
Sally Reese, I serve as the vice provost for academic affairs, also happy to be here. At UConn, I'm sorry, I should have said that.
My name is Braden Hosh. I am the Director of Policy and Research for the Board of Regents for Higher Education. I'm also the Interim Director of Academic and Student Affairs. I am Dr. Gray's designee ex officio to the commission.
I'm Lois Schneider. I'm an independent management consultant representing science and technology.
Hedley Freak, a professor of nutritional sciences and former administrator at the University of Connecticut, appointed by Senator Williams.
John Bennett, emeritus faculty at the University of Connecticut, and I was appointed by Representative Cafaro.
Commissioner Catherine Smith, Department of Economic and Community Development.
Judith Diamond, I'm the president of the Connecticut Conference of Independent Colleges, representing the CCIC, the independent sector.
Judy Goldfarb, early childhood consultant, appointed by the governor.
I'm John Shimo, the vice president and director of economic development for the Metro Hartford Alliance.
I'm John Harnick from the Office of Legislative Management. We're here in a support role regarding the RFP for the strategic plan.
Indeed.
I'm State Representative Roberta Willis and the House Chair of the Higher Education and Employment Advancement Committee. Welcome to everyone. I also want to take this opportunity, mention this to some people in the audience, are representing over here as the legislative staff. Do you want to introduce yourself? And we'll go around the room so people know who's here.
Mary Beth Sullivan, Office of Legislative Research.
Terry Adams, Office of Legislative Research, and we staff the Higher Education Committee.
Can we ask the people that just came in to introduce themselves, please, and tell us where you're from?
Ben, why don't you just join us at the table? Right, wherever you'd like to sit. Thank you so much for coming.
Please indulge us if we make one slight change to the agenda. I know that our folks from legislative management need to leave early, so if we would be so kind as to move the item about the progress report on the RFP to the top. And John, you're on.
Okay, as you all know, we've issued the RFP. We have already had a number of questions that we responded to by the due date. The RFP itself, the responses are due July 18th, and then the next step will be to work with the committee, the evaluation committee, that will be chaired by Judy, and we'll facilitate arranging for everybody to get packets, do their analysis, formulate a strategy as to how many of the respondents we'd like to speak with, and we will arrange that and then ultimately make a decision and develop a contract.
Please.
John, I think there was a period during which the possible responders could ask questions that ends before the 13th. Is that right?
Oh, Tina, check the actual date. We've already completed that assignment.
Questions were due June 25th and the other one to the 1st of July.
Okay.
Other questions? Just to let you know that the group that actually wrote the RFP will be involved with evaluating it as well. And we hope to ask the governor's office to send a representative to join us as well, too. So buckle in, and hopefully we'll have a good set of consultants to evaluate. So with that, let's move on to the meat of the meeting. We're delighted today to have Monica Chen from the New England Board of Higher Education. I think we're going to be really stimulated to think a lot about our work going forward, especially as we talk about how Connecticut compares to New England states in a variety of different settings. So Monica serves as the Director of Policy and Research at NEBI and has a lot to tell us. So Monica, it's yours. Please.
Great. Thank you for that introduction. I hope I live up to expectations. Hi, everyone. I'm so glad to be here. Thank you so much, Representative Willis and all of you, for the opportunity to engage with you in this conversation. I'm very excited to be here. I probably said that already, because statewide planning is a topic of much interest at NEBI, particularly given work that we have planned for this fall in conjunction with our fall board meeting. And I hope that we'll have the chance to have an engaging conversation and share each of our perspectives, because I have a feeling that I and others in New England definitely have much to learn from all of you in the process that you've undertaken here. So I have some slides today that are going to be behind most of you, so hopefully that won't cause too many neck cramps. But hopefully they'll help to illustrate my perspective at NEBI. But that said, please feel free to jump in at any time. Again, I'm hoping to have this as much of a conversation as possible. And so beginning by comparing, by sharing some contextual information here, for someone with strong professional interest in higher education and its impact and role in the public agenda, New England is a really great place to be. We have a high concentration of post-secondary institutions, 260 nonprofit ones, in fact. And that map that you see at the corner shows that distribution across the six New England states. The different colored dots represent different sectors. And these institutions contribute an estimated $100 billion annually in overall impact. They employ over 200,000 people, and they enrolled almost 1 million students in fall of 2011. From this perspective, as a regional organization, we work to serve this robust post-secondary ecosystem by expanding educational opportunities and resources. More formally, we are an interstate agency that was chartered by the six New England governors and congressionally authorized in the 1950s. And we seek to serve the six New England states on three key areas. These are cost savings and affordability, college readiness and success, as well as looking at higher education's link to local and regional economic development. And we work across these areas through a variety of different programs, projects, events, and publications. And to give you a brief overview of that, the Regional Student Program is the keystone program. That is why we were formed and why we were chartered. And this is a tuition discount program, if you will, for New England residents. So as a Massachusetts resident, if I decided to, say, enroll in marine biology at the University of Rhode Island, I could do so and pay slightly less than the out-of-state rate and slightly more than the in-state rate. And so that's the crux of the tuition break program, if you will. in addition to that, we do convene leaders and decision makers and individuals such as yourselves, and I know that some of you are familiar with these events, having either attended or been on the agenda. And so we do host issue-oriented conferences as well as an annual Excellence Awards. We also provide professional and curriculum development in the STEM fields, so we are now on the next stage of an NSF grant. It's a 3-year grant, and we're focused on advanced manufacturing specifically. From a publication standpoint, the New England Journal of Higher Education is a purely online journal. It was formerly known as Connection. And we also publish policy briefs and data and analysis and things of that sort. More broadly, there are some things about New England's higher education system that I'll review quickly today. The first is that historically, as a region, we're known for funding our public higher education at a level that's lower than the rest of the country. It's true that, you know, this perspective may be particularly colored by a few states that provide some of the lowest levels of funding in the country. That is not Connecticut. And you'll notice on this table here that Connecticut does stand out as a New England state that's often above the national average. I should note that with these figures, Maine, Massachusetts, Rhode Island, and Vermont have federal stimulus funds included in this, so those numbers are a bit inflated. And when we think about tuition and fees, again, thinking broadly about where public higher education in New England is as a sector, I should note that we also have a reputation for being very expensive, and this is also true for the private sectors. But these two tables are from a tuition and fee report that we published earlier this year, and the table on the left shows public 4-year in-state tuition and fees by state, and the right shows the 2-year published in-state tuition and fees by state. And that blue line across the middle there is the U.S. average, and you'll see that all 6 New England states are above average. Notably, the Maine community college system is very close to that average. And yet, even with this context, New England continues to be very attractive to students. And perhaps it's that diverse mix of institutions that we talked about, the high concentration that I mentioned in that first slide with that map. But regardless, our region imports many college students. An analysis from the Federal Reserve Bank of Boston finds that about 1 in 3 college students are from outside the region, which is pretty exciting. And some of these students do end up staying in the region after graduating, and that helps to contribute, among other things, to the higher average degree attainment rates that we see across the region, and that's what that table is on this slide that's up on the screen right now. And so in Connecticut, for example, you'll see that about 46% of working age adults had an associate's degree or higher in 2011, and that's compared to approximately 39% nationwide. And although, you know, this is pretty exciting in terms of we're doing great as a region, I do think that there's some sobering economic context that I'm sure all of you are very familiar with. The New England Economic Partnership, for example, projects slower economic growth in the region compared to the rest of the country moving forward. And I wanted to reiterate this, even though I know that it's a reality many of us are facing on a day-to-day basis in our jobs outside of this room. But I did want to highlight that because I think that that'll be an important context for this discussion. And I hope that, again, we'll be able to have a conversation about it moving forward. In Connecticut specifically, these modest recovery forecasts were especially the case. And so NEEP has projected that the recovery in Connecticut will be less robust than in Massachusetts and Vermont, but a little bit more robust than in Rhode Island and Maine. And yet, even with this slow job and employment growth, projections for a greater need for post-secondary education among workers still pop up. And this is this chart that you see on the right here, and I apologize for the small font. It's difficult to fit in so many states. But this is a chart that outlines all 50 states and the projected educational requirements in the workforce. So what this graph shows is that by 2020, and if you look at that red bar in the middle there, that's the national projection of 65%. The Georgetown Center for Education in the Workforce is projecting that 65% of jobs in the U.S. by 2020 will require some post-secondary education. And so what I've done here is I've highlighted Connecticut with that red box. And by 2020, the Georgetown Center is expecting 70% of Connecticut jobs to require some post-secondary education. And this is above that national expectation of 65%. And so I guess the question is, you know, if we have these projections of we're going to need a more educated workforce and our economy really is going to be struggling to recover, and it's going to be slow to recover moving forward, what's next, and what is the role that higher education can play in the state economy? And if you'll indulge me here, I'm going to share with you a table that was published in 2007, and so this was published by the National Center for Higher Education Management Systems, NCHEMS, and it displays the relationship between degree production and migration rate across all 50 states. So if you look at each quadrant, you'll see that if I were to start at that bottom left quadrant there, so quadrant three, these states have both low degree production, so this is a lower number of degrees that's awarded per 1,000 participants in the labor force, as well as a negative migration rate of college-educated workers. And so the thinking is that if you're a state in that quadrant, it means that perhaps as a state, you may be underproducing college-educated workers, and you're also losing college-educated workers, so you might not have the state economy there to support a strong ecosystem and a strong employer base. And so if we were to move counterclockwise then those states in the bottom right with a higher degree production and a net negative migration rate, what that says is that, you know, maybe your post-secondary institutions are doing really well at producing graduates, but maybe your state can't support them from an employer standpoint, and that's why you have a negative net migration. And if we were to move up, you know, all those other quadrants, that relationship follows. And Connecticut here is in that second quadrant, and so this is at the top left. And so what that quadrant depicts, if you will, is a low degree production but a net importer. And so again, this was in 2007, so I realize that things have changed a bit, but I do think that this framework is an interesting one to consider because it proposes that for states in the second quadrant, they're importing college-educated workers, if you will. So these are college-educated adults of working age between 22 and 64. But at the same time, they're not necessarily overproducing degree holders. So they could do better in terms of their degree production. And so if I were to synthesize this chart a little bit more, I realize that it's very complicated and there are many little letters up there. But if I were to synthesize it a bit, I think that there are, in essence, two potential frameworks here for looking at higher education's role in the state economy. One is as a workforce developer, aka boosting degree completion. And the second is as a workplace developer. So, in essence, supporting innovation, entrepreneurship, and other forms of economic development. And as I said, you know, those frameworks have been around for a long time. But given today's economic context, if I may, I'd like to propose that perhaps both of these frameworks be considered simultaneously when we think about a statewide plan and a statewide vision for higher education. So from this point on, I'm going to be sharing some thoughts and data on both of these topics. So I'll pause for a minute, and if there are any questions or comments, definitely feel free to jump in. But with that, if not, then I'll start with talking about boosting degree completion and this idea of workforce development. And so if you'll indulge me a little bit further and sort of think through this cartoon with me or follow it, if you will, you can see that from how I think about degree completion, I think about it in terms of what a student goes through in their post-secondary experience. And so if that post-secondary experience is that gray arrow and the student is the little green cartoon, a student can enter post-secondary education from multiple points. They could be a recent high school graduate. They could be a returning adult. And at the same time, they can also exit the post-secondary institution that they had originally entered in, either by transferring to another institution or taking a break and stopping out or not completing their degree altogether. So I think there are a lot of factors here that affect whether or not a student completes their degree, which in turn affects the overall degree attainment rates for a state. Given all of these points, if I could just be very broad again and split them up into two categories, I'm going to split them up here into enrollment and persistence. And I'm going to share with you in the next slides some data on both of these. And so beginning with enrollment, this table is from the U.S. Department of Education's Trend Generator, and it depicts the undergraduate and graduate student enrollment across institution types in Connecticut. And you can see that although the number of private and public institutions are similar, many more students are enrolled in a public institution in Connecticut than in a private one. I should say that from the New England region as a whole, that's flipped. There are many more students in New England that are enrolled in a private institution than in a public institution. In addition to looking at undergraduate and graduate enrollment levels, there's also I think, the opportunity here to think about full-time and part-time students. And this is thinking about enrollment by student characteristics. And in this case, that characteristic would be enrollment intensity. And this table outlines, again, the full-time and part-time enrollment by sector. And you'll see here that in fall 2011, the Connecticut two-year public institutions served many more part-time students than full-time students, which is flipped, if you will, for their public four-year and private four-year nonprofit counterparts. I'd say that another student characteristic to consider in addition to enrollment intensity is low income and the socioeconomic status of these students. And so post-secondary education opportunity estimates the low-income student enrollment rates based on the number of students that were eligible for free and reduced price lunch in a state's K-12 system. And then they follow that cohort, if you will, through when they would enroll in post-secondary education directly after high school. And so based on this measure, Connecticut post-secondary institutions do better at enrolling low-income students than the country as a whole. So those are those top two lines there. So Connecticut enrolls about, let's say, an estimate of 47% of those students that were eligible for free and reduced price lunch, and they connect that to the post-secondary experience by looking at a student's Pell Grant status, and it's slightly higher than the U.S. average. And, you know, at the same time, I'd say that as a region, we're doing pretty good at that if we were to take that calculation as a rough estimate of this. But as many of you know, enrollment isn't the whole story. And if we're talking about boosting degree completion and this idea of workforce development, then we also need to look at graduation rates and degree completion. So these next two slides are going to be the 6-year and 3-year graduation rates for 4-year and 2-year institutions. So this first slide here is for Connecticut 4-year post-secondary institutions by sector. And that red line is the overall graduation rate for Connecticut. The dotted line at the top is private, not-for-profit institutions. And the slashed line, if you will, sort of in the middle there, are the public institutions in Connecticut. And the slash dotted lines are the private for-profit. And so you'll see that the graduation rates for the 6-year graduation rates, this is for first-time full-time students across Connecticut, differs by sector. I'll say that very squiggly line there for the private for-profits varies a lot. I think something to consider is that the number of institutions may vary during this time, and that sector in general may or may not see more volatile, may be more volatile, if you will, than the nonprofit side. But all of this is to say is that there's still a range in graduation rates. When we look at the public 2-year institutions, Connecticut is not performing quite as high as the rest of the country. So this is the 3-year graduation rates for first-time full-time students at 2-year public institutions. The solid line is the national average, and the dotted line is Connecticut, and this is, again, over time. And for those of you who are familiar with these graduation rates, I know that you're probably aware of their limitations. So they're only snapshots, you know, a first-time full-time student completion, and they don't take into account different student characteristics, different institutional missions, student transfer, different pathways, and all of those things that really do affect student persistence. And so if I could just propose and share with you some data and some ways of digging a little bit deeper into these completion rates, I'm going to talk and give an example about student characteristics and student pathways. So when we think about persistence and when we think about student characteristics, I think an example that we had talked about before was this idea of socioeconomic status. And post-secondary education opportunity has estimated that students from the top income quartile are 7 times more likely to have earned a bachelor's degree by age 24 than students from the top income quartile. So even if we're looking at institution or sector-specific graduation rates, it's clear that not all institutions are equal, just as much as not all students are equal. And I think the inputs here for an institution are very important. And this data that you see here was actually provided by Dr. Hosh from the Connecticut Board of Regents, so thank you. And you'll see on that top table It's the graduation rate for students who are seeking an associate's degree at Connecticut Community Colleges, and this is the fall 2006 cohort. And you'll see that those students who are full-time, first-time, who came in and did not receive a Pell Grant, so they were not eligible for Pell, and graduated in 3 years at about 11%. So that's that middle column there on the top chart that I'm looking at. On the flip side, those full-time, first-time students who are entering a Connecticut Community College and did receive a Pell Grant graduated in 3 years at a rate that's slightly less than 10%. So there is a gap, and that gap is repeated for the Connecticut State Universities. So if we're looking at that middle column again on that second table, so this would be now a six-year graduation rate for first-time, full-time students, you'll see that those students who were not eligible for Pell, perhaps because they're expected family income was too high, so these are not, you know, those students that are quote-unquote low income in this scenario here. Those students graduated at about 47%, and those students that did receive a Pell Grant, so in this case low income, those students graduated at about less than had a gap of about 5% in their graduation rate when compared to those students who did not receive a Pell Grant. So I think that this is one way of thinking about some of the student completion data and the graduation rate data that's out there. I know that that's a big part in planning and thinking about some of the goals that we're setting, but I do think that it's important to take into account who are the students that are entering your system and what is a thoughtful way where we can think about measuring, if you will, you know, whether or not we're successful in meeting goals. The next factor that I wanted to talk about in terms of student persistence is this idea of student pathways. And student post-secondary pathways can wind across institutions, and they can vary in enrollment intensity. So, for example, I was a full-time student at my undergraduate institution, and then the second semester of my senior year, I decided to become a part-time student. And so in that sense, I wouldn't have been captured in the full-time, first-time graduation rate data because I was no longer a full-time student at the end. And so this idea of including part-time students and transfer students is an important thing to consider. I think it's difficult to do because it's really dependent on whether or not a state or an institution has sort of the data capacity there to track students either across institutions, across state lines, et cetera, et cetera. But the National Student Clearinghouse recently published a report that did attempt to do this. And so I've included their data here for Connecticut. The private four-year nonprofit institutions are not included in this because they did not have a high enough coverage rate. And so they looked at their historical coverage rate for their institutions, and because the National Student Clearinghouse provides a product that institutions buy into. So if an institution doesn't purchase their data software student management process, and I apologize that I'm losing my words here, then they wouldn't be covered, if you will, and so the National Student Clearinghouse wouldn't have access to that student data, which is why the private nonprofits are not included here. But even so, if we were to look at the public sector, what you'll see for both the 4 year and 2 years is that the total completion rate here is much higher than those graphs that we were looking at before. So the total completion rate for students who started at a public four-year institution is 69%. And 13% of that are students who completed after transferring to another institution. So we are missing a significant chunk of students in those graduation rates from the Department of Education. They're certainly still valid because everybody else is, you know, inputting their data on the same measure, but I do think that this is another thing to consider. Yes, this is six-year data from the National Student Clearinghouse. They were looking at a cohort as of May 2012. And the public two-year total completion rate is 30%, and that completion after transfer, so 8% of that is accounted for by students who completed their degree at an institution other than the one that they began at. And when I think about a 50,000-foot view, when I think about all of these factors that can affect these student decisions and whether or not a student is able to pay for college either, you know, because of their socioeconomic status or other things that happen along the pipeline, given our interest at NEBI in cost reduction and affordability, I think about, you know, is there a connection between student persistence and cost? And I know that anecdotally and from personal experience, that's very much the case. And so because of that, I wanted to share with you two additional points of data to consider when we think about student persistence. The first is that New England institutions are very tuition dependent. Part of this is, you know, related to the levels of state appropriations historically. But in Connecticut, and this is our analysis here of Delta Cost data, Delta Cost Project data from the Department of Education, and what you see here are the percentages of net tuition revenue as a percentage of education and related expenses. So by sector, how much of it is represented by net tuition revenue? How much of the expenditures that an institution spends on education and related costs is represented by net tuition revenue? And so what you see is, you know, as expected, the public institutions should rely less on net tuition revenue, if you will. And so that's why those percentages are lower. Whereas the private four-year institutions that don't have state appropriations in, you know, the same sense that the publics do would thus, by, you know, it makes sense that they would have a higher dependence or utilize more of their net tuition revenue as part of their education and related cost expenditure. So that's one data point that I wanted to share when we think about persistence and some of the things that affect the student pathway and the costs that they see. The second is the idea of how state aid plays a role and institutional aid plays a role in student completion. And so a national report that was recently published suggests that 89% of private colleges, and this is across the United States, and 34% of public colleges charge students with family incomes of $30,000 or less an average net price over $10,000. And I think that this is something to consider because when we think about the intersection between institutional tuition setting policies or system tuition setting policies, state and institutional aid policies, student aid policies, as well as state appropriations, I think there are times when those three policies may intersect in a way that results in consequences that are unintended for students. And so I think it's important to think about who's setting those policies, when are they being set, and if there's any coordination across the three. And with that, I'm going to move to the second framework, if you will, if there aren't any comments or questions, and thinking about entrepreneurship and economic development. So if I were to think about higher education as a workplace developer, if I could propose two ways of thinking about this again here. So the first is that when I think about higher education as a workplace developer, I think about sectors and industry sectors. And how does higher education play a role across multiple sectors? I think it's interesting that higher education is able to be so flexible and it's able to work across so many different sectors, if you will, that we have in an economy. The other thing that I think about is the structural framework of how higher education plays a role in the workplace. And I've put this here as new partnership models. So thinking about what are the partnership models that politically, culturally, historically would be successful here in Connecticut or in any other state that's thinking about this, and where are there opportunities for thinking about new partnership models and new opportunities. Focusing on the sectors a bit, I wanted to share this with you because sector matters. At the end of the day, sector matters. When we think about the return on investment of increasing degree attainment in a state, it matters what sector those graduates are employed in, and it matters what their wages, because that's going to impact any ROI calculation that we're going to make. And so this chart here shows the median wage by educational attainment in Connecticut. It's averaged across the years 2006 to 2010. This data was produced by the State Higher Education Executive Officers Association. It was published in December of 2012. And what you see are just the variation between median wage by educational attainment rate, which are all of those different colors, within specific sectors. And I wanted to point this out because not all sectors are equal, just as much as not all degrees are equal. So, for example, I was a biochemistry major in undergrad, and you'll see in the STEM field the green dot is higher than the pink dot in education, or really even the blue dot in education. And when I think about that, I think about, well, if I had stayed in biochemistry instead of working in education, my career path might be really different, and I might be seeing a lot of different kinds of opportunities. Neither is good or bad. You know, I'm very thankful for being where I am, but I do think that that's an example of how a higher level degree in one field may return way more than a higher degree in another field, if that makes sense. Yes. It's the discipline categories, yes. So this data came from the American Community Survey. So what it did was it looked at if I were filling out that survey and if I said, oh, I have a graduate or a professional degree in this sector and this was my median income and all of that. Mm-hmm. So when we think about sectors and partnership models and all of that, and, you know, when we think about how sectors are important, that takes me now to sort of the structural frame, if you will, of thinking about different partnership models. And traditionally, in higher education, I think we focused on the R&D and this idea of creating options and doing laboratory research and proof of concept and prototyping. And so I've covered the rest of that chart for now with some of the traditional metrics that we use to measure research and development. And so this is from our Trends and Indicators, which is available on our website, and it shows the total R&D at New England colleges and universities by state. I apologize, I cut the year off. I do believe that this is for fiscal year 2011, but this is NSF data. And you'll see that Connecticut is second to Massachusetts, and New England in general has historically had a lot of R&D funding from the federal government. But if I may, I think that another way to think about new partnership models and to think about ways that higher education could be involved are illustrated by the rest of that figure that I had covered up in that previous slide. And this figure is from a preliminary report from MIT's Industrial Performance Center. So they had done some studies on some of the MIT spinoffs and startups and sort of how did they bring their idea to market and how were they ultimately successful. And I think that this preliminary report for me was really interesting because as somebody who's very much an outside observer for how higher education plays a role in the economy, I think that this is an interesting map, if you will, of some of the different places where higher education could play a role, and that knowledge exchange, those arrows, I think is where there's opportunity here for thinking about new models. What the MIT study found was that there are a lot of institutions that support innovation and entrepreneurship. And what happens is that when all of these products are taken to market, that inflection band, if you will, and that idea of going from a small product in a lab or in an incubator to being this large-scale product that's produced at a commercial scale, making that switch is really tough because the financing is really hard to find. And what they found was that those individuals that they interviewed that were able to make that successful transition, a lot of times they found their financing abroad, and a lot of times they moved abroad for manufacturing to make their product. And I think that that's really interesting when we think about how things are shifting and how before, and I think what the model used to be was that we were able to find financing here and individuals were able to manufacture their products here and they didn't need to move abroad to manufacture whatever product it was that they were making. And so I think that, again, you know, when we think about new partnership models, I think this economy is now in a place where we do need to be a little bit more innovative and we do need to think about new structures for how we can partner across different entities. And so this report proposes three different models, which I think is pretty interesting, and I do think that this is similar to a lot of examples that are out there already, probably in Connecticut. So if I'm boring you to death, please tell me, and certainly please correct me, because I'm sure there's much more experience here in the room in this than what I have. But the first model that they have was convening. So this idea of institutions and others being able to convene groups of people together around an issue and really talk about it and work together and collaborate So, for example, having an incubator space or having some sort of space at an institution where people are able to come together and share equipment and share resources and share knowledge. The second is coordinating, and so helping to work together to, say, manage risk or to navigate different protocols or different reporting requirements and that sort of thing. And the last one is this idea of managing risk, and they have two models for it. One is risk pooling, and one is risk reduction, both of which I find is really interesting, with risk reduction being this idea of, can institutions assist with some of the analysis and things that goes into these risk calculations? And then the risk pooling being this idea of, well, as a small business enterprise, I can't afford a 3D printer, but I would really like one, but it's kind of risky because if they don't take off, then what do I do? So maybe working with institutions to find a way to pool all of the risk together so that that way we're all jointly investing in something. So I think that, and I would definitely encourage you to read this report, because certainly probably most of you have more background than I do in this, but I do think that there are some interesting models here for how institutions could work with business and communities and other entities. Oop, I'm going the wrong way. Sorry about that. So with that, if I were to summarize, we talked about higher education's role in the state economy, and we talked about two different frameworks, the first being workforce development and the second being workplace development. And going back to workforce development, I mentioned this earlier, but I think it's very important to examine that relationship between state and institutional aid, tuition and fees, and state appropriations. And I would say, if we were to take this outside of the affordability conversation to other things, such as quality or transfer, student transfer, any of those things, I think that having more coordination would be helpful. And I think it's also really important when thinking about planning, if I could just make a suggestion, to really think about what type of financing policies are going to work with for Connecticut and for Connecticut students. Are we thinking about high tuition, high aid models? Are we thinking about low tuition, low aid models? Are we thinking about other financing policies in general? So that way there's a sense of direction for where we're going, because we're talking about boosting degree completion, but we need to think about some of the other factors that affect degree completion. And more of a process question that I would ask in addition to that is, what is the level of coordination among decision makers? And what is the timing? In some of the literature, you'll see that sometimes the state appropriation decisions are made first, and then the institutions set their tuition and fees so that way they can make sure that they have enough revenue coming in for the upcoming academic year to serve their students, which I think is a really important thing. I think institutions do need to be fiscally sound, if that makes sense. But at the same time, I think there could be perhaps maybe more coordination, and we did see this a lot in the last legislative session with a number of states making deals, if you will, with the legislature that if they hold funding, we'll hold tuition and fees, or if you increase funding and restore it to a certain level, we'll hold tuition and fees and that sort of thing. So I think coordination is a good thing and worthy of conversation. In terms of the workplace, if I may, I think, again, it's important to think about, what sorts of sectors are we looking to develop here in Connecticut, and what type of partnership roles might work for Connecticut business and higher education sectors and community groups and association groups and that sort of thing. Because I think what I found is a lot of times, in states we'll say, okay, we're going to develop our STEM workforce and we're going to focus on STEM. But if there isn't a thought as to what sort of partnerships are possible, sometimes those grand ideas to boost STEM degree production, while fantastic, don't really have a guiding light once, we've reached that degree completion goal, or once we've worked towards enrolling all of these students in all of these new programs, if that makes sense. So with that, those are really the thoughts that I had in terms of some of the ways to think about a lot of the data that's out there, and with hopefully some framework to structure some of it.
Thank you, Monica. Fascinating. Questions? Lindy?
I'm not sure whether your group would know this or not, but I'm very curious as to the correlation between student internships and completion, and more than that, student internships and retention of those students within the state post-graduation?
That's a great question. I wish I had hard data to share with you. I'm not sure if others here do, but I do know one example is the Federal Reserve Bank of Boston. Their public policy center has been working with Massachusetts, I believe, with Boston specifically, at developing internship programs with this idea of trying to retain graduates after graduating. Because New England, even though we bring in a lot of students, we also see a lot of students leave after graduation, perhaps because they're going back home. There's a lot of reasons for that. But I don't have the hard data for you.
So if I may just add, based on knowledge that's gathered from the National Association of Cooperative Education, it demonstrates that internship does increase persistence in several ways. One is it gets them more involved in their discipline, learning more about it, but also provides additional income for the students to complete their degrees. So there are many important aspects to internship, and as part of NextGen Connecticut, working with industry so that our students, as they're going for their STEM degrees, have that access to industrial relevant experience is going to be very critical. So that's a very good point.
Interestingly enough, I just had a conversation with a large medical device manufacturer last week. Long time ago, we worked with them to start an internship program, and they've taken it on themselves without grant dollars. And they now see it as a hiring, it's a talent pool. They're doing it specifically, that, mm-hmm. you know, especially in the engineering field. And they actually have collected data that talks about the importance to them. And these are all students that did their internships in either junior or senior year, and then they were hired.
Right.
So there's data from the business community as mm-hmm. well to support that.
And if I could just add to that, just because I didn't have the data, I didn't mean to say that there isn't a relationship. I'm sure that there is. If I could just draw a parallel, service learning is another example of students doing hands-on experiential learning, and that's been shown to increase student persistence. So I would imagine that an internship would be very similar to that.
Other questions?
Just a comment. One of the things we found with our Pell Grant High Poverty First Generation students, the biggest contributor to student persistence and graduation to date has been study abroad programs. So I just would add that that's, you know, our rate goes from about 64% to 90% graduation rate, and when our high poverty first generation students do study abroad. So it's something that we've invested more in at UConn, but I think that, you know, I think that's important to note as well. So there's a number of areas, internships being one, student engagement, living and learning communities, but I'd also want to point to study abroad.
That's an interesting point, Sally. And maybe we should be looking at that as our legislative research comes in. What's offered statewide, our institutions, if you could check into that, public and private, and how many students, their percentage of students do study abroad, and whether we can get graduation rates and compare that, how we're doing. Because I know there's more and more schools in Connecticut that are really trying to increase the opportunities for study abroad.
John?
Thank you. I would also point out the thing that I think it can be, when in present, a big role, and that is this notion of a sense of purpose that can come from outreach on vacation periods or from small projects that are done within the school but in fact delivered elsewhere in the country or elsewhere in the world as far as that goes. I suspect that has I believe strongly, but I don't have the data, that itself also adds significantly to persistence and to the meaningfulness with which they take their job selection and their career aspirations.
I understand that this commission, one of the foci is supposed to be the gap, achievement gap in completion rates. And so with that in mind, we saw here the influence of income on retention and degree completion. And I wondered if you have any data available on the influence of gender and on the influence of race and ethnicity within New England on those factors, and also what you're actually studying.
Great question. I don't have the exact numbers with me, but certainly that is actually something that we're working on at the moment, so I'm happy to send along what I have as a follow-up to this meeting, if that would be helpful. I will say that something that's been interesting sort of in the national conversation is this idea of educational attainment rates across racial groups. Certainly, I think with gender, I think many of you are probably familiar with that idea that the gender gap has flipped to a certain extent, in the sense that many more women now are attaining their degrees than men. So I do think that that's an issue that is of interest in higher education policy conversations, is this idea of how can we better support men, particularly low-income men of color. And with the race issue, I think that there's been some concern. I do believe that Latinos as a group are, in terms of their degree attainment rates, are growing very quickly. But I'll need to check on sort of the exact breakdown and how does that look in New England. I will say that the southern New England states are much more racially diverse than the northern New England states. And so there are definitely some things that Connecticut, Rhode Island, and Massachusetts are looking at that will be very different from what Vermont, New Hampshire, and Maine are looking at demographically.
And does it matter what you study?
In terms of field of study?
Yeah.
You know, I haven't thought of that. I will say that, you know, being a woman of color in biochemistry, it mattered. There were a lot of programs that were there, and there were a lot of opportunities that were there. And I know that there are still many programs that try to incentivize students of color to study certain fields, but I don't know in terms of, say, a return on investment from a wage premium, what that would look like.
Just a reminder, too, since we're being televised, to make sure that if you ask a question that you put your mic on, please. Brayden, I was wondering if you had any data.
Yes, just to follow up on that question, both the national data and Connecticut data show relatively large gaps in graduation rates by race, ethnicity, as well as by gender. The selectivity of the institution does have an effect on the size of those gaps to some extent, so that as the institutions become more selective, the gaps tend to close because there's more of a floor put in place. But that's not unique to Connecticut. It appears to happen across the country.
Yes, Judy.
Monica or anyone else, do you have any anecdotal or hard data on sharing faculty across institutions? I know you've talked about coordinating resources, but I was wondering about actual staff.
Great question. I have been hearing more and more this idea of institutions sharing faculty and sharing degree programs. I think it's an interesting way to pool resources together to serve more students, particularly for institutions where, you know, there may only be one major in a department or five majors in a department. I do think that there's some interesting work happening in the UK. It's called a CIVS project, and it's this idea of working to preserve knowledge around fields that are perhaps less popular and less in, you know, sort of the forefront of everybody's mind. And I know that as an organization, it's something that we're interested in and we're keeping track of. So I do think that it happens. That being said, I think it probably depends on whether or not the faculty are unionized and who's paying what and how do benefits work and all of that.
Other questions? I mean, I did have a question on the graduation rates in the two-year colleges. Do we account at all in the data for individuals that are coming back to a two-year college not for degrees, that are looking at, you know, sector-based career pathway, things that are going to give them a promotion, and they never intended to graduate?
Monica looks at me. What I can tell you is among entering students at community colleges, and I will include transfer in this, 85% intend to earn a credential, so a degree or certificate. And those people are in graduation rates that you saw in the National Student Clearinghouse piece. Now, the pathways become very complicated as you start to talk about a lot of these students. And so there's not a lot of apples-to-apples data, but most, and when I say 80, 85%, that's most. Most of those students are not intending to simply come to the community colleges just to take various coursework. Now, what I have not mentioned here is the non-credit activity. Non-credit students are about 30,000 and change across the community colleges. That often intersects more with the business workplace, and none of those people were actually in the things that Monica was talking about today. So that activity is important. The data on it is a little bit muddy because there's not a great deal of consistency among it, and Judy knows well, but that's sort of an overview.
John.
Yes, do we have any data on the percentage of students that drop out, say, after one semester, 1 year, and so on?
In my experience, institutions do collect that. It's known as a student retention number, and I'm not sure how it's reported nationally, but.
So we do keep track of that, and all institutions do that as well. At the University of Connecticut, our first year retention rate is about 93%, and that ranks pretty high nationally among public universities.
Seems to me that in terms of the whole persistence issue, that there's got to be, I would think, a fairly significant percentage of students that drop out because they made a poor choice in college to begin with. I know we don't talk about that too much, but certainly it's an enormous drain on those students' time, on financial resources, and so forth. So I think maybe it's a bigger issue than we give it credit for.
John.
Interestingly enough, while I was a faculty member at UConn for many years, I did a first-year experience course, which is pretty widespread at UConn. And I very often got to expect, and it happened regularly, that after the first set of exams, as we all know, nobody, myself included, ever did well enough as compared to what they thought they would do. I still have the letters that I sent my parents back in the dark ages. But the point I wanted to make was that I would know this was coming up, and my class was very much a volunteer type thing. We talked about what the students wanted to talk about. And invariably, during this first time after the first exams, we would get around to somebody saying, you know, I don't think I belong in college. I don't think I'm a college member, picking up on your point, John. And I would assure them that from my information that I got from the admissions office, UConn never admits anybody they don't think can do the work if they decide to do the work. But rather, probably what happened was that there were some things that they weren't doing right. But still, about a third, by their anecdotal volunteer admissions of each class, said that they never made a conscious decision to go to college. That it was just kind of rolling along with the tumbleweeds, you know, that, well, of course I'm going to college because everybody says I'm going to college, and that's what you hear on the news and everything else. And some of them actually wished that they did have the gap year like they do in England and some of the other places, that after having been a semester, that's what they would wish for.
Do we also collect data in terms of retention by age demographic, too? Do we see a difference between persistence between younger, I mean, I'm thinking about this, you know, gap year and 18-year-olds versus the adult student that's coming back. Do we know anything about that?
Well, we have it. UConn, you won't see much of it because they're entering class, and full-time, first-time students are, generally speaking, all coming directly from high school, so that there's not a whole lot of 25-year-olds entering in that group. We do have it in the community colleges, and we do have it in the state universities a little bit, but not too much. Again, it's a community college phenomenon. They tend to do slightly better than do students entering from high school, about 5 to 7 percentage points, depending on the institution.
Other questions? Very quiet group. I mean, it's a lot to think over. Thank you, Monica.
Monica, what interested me is the financing policies. And I was wondering, is there information or studies that compare different states on financing? I mean, where would one go to access that and to see if there definitely is, you know, a policy outcome? I know it's hard comparing New England states to Midwestern states in terms of financing because we have so many private institutions. I think it changes our viewpoint on tuition. Well, in the Midwest, most schools are public institutions, and they spend, you know, their higher education dollars at public institutions, and I'm sure there's a greater commitment of the state to do that. So where would one go to get that?
That's a great question. You know, it's funny that you bring that up because I was just at a meeting last week where they were talking about somehow finding a way to quantify and measure the impact of policy on student completion. And I unfortunately think it's very difficult to find. It's possible to find case studies and to find, you know, a lot of information about how a finance policy is structured or how states have worked to coordinate their financing policies, but I think that question of what is the exact impact a policy has on student completion is, I don't know if it's, right now, if that information is available. I will say that in terms of what types of financing policies, I'm happy to pull together, you know, state examples for you on how states have coordinated on financing policies. I will say that when thinking about comparing to other states, I think there's the issue that you brought up in terms of culture and how do we perceive our public system. But I'll also say that governance and the role of different coordinating bodies and who has which decision-making power, because it varies so much across states, even if, you know, one state calls their Board of Higher Education Board of Higher Education and so does another state, the responsibilities might be different. So I think all of those will play a role as well in thinking about setting a financing policy that works for a specific state within a specific political, cultural context.
I can add a comment. In one of the view graphs that Monica showed, it does show educational appropriations per FTE, and it demonstrates that in the U.S. it's about $5,900 per student, and I'm assuming this is for public universities. And New England overall ranks slightly below that.
Is that a hint?
Not at all.
Ben, did you pay attention to that?
Yes, I saw the chart, and Connecticut appeared to rank well above the average for New England. So I would just point that out.
Our cost of living is a little higher. So.
No, I was paying attention. The question, though, that you raise is an interesting one, but can you get... There must be more information about the relationship between affordability, either on the individual student basis or on the overall institutional basis, between affordability and retention. I mean, I'm just sort of assuming that one of the reasons people drop out of school, stop going, is because they can't afford to make the tuition payments anymore because they're high and difficult to make. Is there data on that? I think you may have covered that briefly. And does that is that available sort of across? I mean, is that sort of a way to get at how school is tuition is supported by state resources? Maybe that's sort of a way to understand that.
So that's a great point, and I have seen surveys that talk about why students drop out, and it cost is definitely, you know, one of the big factors there. In terms of correlating tuition and fee rates with, say, student completion rates and that sort of thing, that's definitely something that we're very interested in doing as a regional organization. I think we've run into some data hang-ups in terms of what's available and what's not, because I think there's a lot of assumptions because every student has a different aid package. So it's hard to know, you know, what sort of supports are they getting that may be affecting whether or not they're staying in school compared with, you know, their peer who might be getting less aid or maybe, you know, is getting federal work study funds or sort of all of these different possibilities and permutations, if you will. So I do think that that's a question of interest in terms of finding that correlation, but again, I'm sorry, I don't seem to have many answers today.
Yeah, I think academic preparation would have to be added to that as well. I mean, when we look at why students are not able to complete, a lot of it has to do with academic preparation. Not at UConn. We do generally very well at that. But if you look across, if we try to increase our retention and we look at studies that have been done, so much of it is correlation with academic preparation. Would you not agree, Brady?
Yeah, I would concur. And there was actually a study done by the Higher Education Research Institute, John Pryor's group out in California, looking at just self-reported high school GPA and the graduation rate. And it was just remarkable that students with an AA plus average out of high school, 80% graduation rate. And then almost every third of a GPA grade point down, you would see the graduation rate drop by 10%. The lesson here being that unless you control for the confounding factor of academic preparation, you're not going to see the effect that the affordability has on the completion rate. So that's been the challenge in untangling that.
I wanted to follow with another slide that you did, and it was on persistence, and it showed a comparison of non-Pell students versus students who were receiving Pell grants. And for the community colleges, it was only 2%, yet the people who got no Pell grants actually completed 2% higher. And in the 4 years, it was 5% higher. So my question is, how does that compare to in either a regional average or a national average? Because it seems to me 2% is almost numerically similar.
The answer is that those data were collected through Complete College America, and they have not fully released their data set for national and state comparisons. The feds have begun to require disclosure of a Pell graduation rate, but haven't required universal reporting of it through IPET. So we don't have national comparisons yet. So I can't quite yet answer your question. I'll look to see when Complete College America is going to release those, but there have been some hiccups with data definitions and things that might give us pause.
One last thought. I know it's a bit on the side of the data you talked about, but did you look at all about, I'm really concerned about student debt coming out of this too. What do we know about student debt levels these days? Based on, you know, even those that complete or, and I'm actually more concerned about those that didn't complete.
I think that's a really good question. Some of the things that have come out from the Federal Reserve Bank in New York and I'd say probably also the Federal Reserve Bank of Boston have looked at the impact that student debt has and who's taking out debt. And what they've found is that a lot of parents are taking out debt to pay for their students, so it's affecting when they can retire, and I'd say from a student and or recent graduate, I think it's affecting when people are deciding to buy homes, when they're deciding to get married and start families, and those sort of lifestyle choices that I think are, you know, pretty tied to state economies in terms of tax returns and that sort of thing. So I think that that's an issue within student debt, and that's an important factor for why it's an important issue. The Project on Student Debt has put out a release that looks at student debt levels on average across the country by state. It's a voluntary survey, so they don't have a 100% coverage rate. I don't have the number for Connecticut off of my head, but
Go ahead. Yeah. So the national debt, nationally the debt is about $26,000. Connecticut is about $28,000 on average. But it ranges quite a bit between private and public. The lowest debt in the state of Connecticut is at Yale, and that's about $6,000, which was surprising. But the highest debt is at University of Bridgeport. And UConn falls about $23,000 in that range.
And if I may add, so those figures are for the debt levels of the graduating senior class. And so I think it's something to think about if I'm graduating and if I have a debt load of, say, $25,000, but if I'm working a really good job, I might be able to pay that off. Whereas if I'm graduating with a debt load of $10,000 and if I can't find a job, then I'm not going to be able to pay that off even if I did graduate. And so I think that's just something to consider when we think about those debt levels.
Another very significant factor is to look at what proportion are borrowing, because it is not universal by any means. Just looking at the figures here, of the undergraduates at Storrs, only 52% borrowed federal loans. Now, that doesn't include the privates that they may have taken out. It's closer to 60% at the state universities, 25% at Charter Oak, and it's only 4% at the community colleges. So it really does matter a lot by sector.
I mean, I wonder if debt is part of the retention, the persistence issue as well, too, is people get scared, you know, and they the only way they can go is to take out loans, and all of a sudden they begin to realize what that means, and they just leave.
I have a quick technical question. When you say that the average debt coming out of Connecticut schools or UConn is in the 25,000, say, whatever, I can't remember the exact number you gave, but only 50% of the students are leaving with any debt, that means that the average for those who have debt is 50,000. Is that correct, or is that the average amongst those with debt?
It's with those with debt.
So half of them have zero, half of them have 25,000 on average.
Right.
Okay, thank you.
A follow-up to that, but is that student debt versus parents' debt? So if the student doesn't have any debt, is it the parent that's walking away with the debt, as I can relate to?
It depends on the type of loan. In some cases, students take out loans. In other cases, parents guarantee loans. So it really just depends. We usually have a range of options available to students.
But I guess my question is, when you say student debt of $26,000 or $28,000, you're not factoring in what the family debt may be.
I think that's the mean combined all debt per student at UConn is about $23,000. So that combines both.
And how does this change when you go to get someone who goes to graduate school? Because I could see an undergraduate degree being an average of $26,000, but if the student's going on to get a graduate degree or a PhD, I mean, the debt load has to be much greater.
Right. The majority of our full-time graduate students pursuing a PhD are supported by the university, either as a teaching assistant, research assistant, or a graduate assistant. And with the graduate assistantship, we're competitive nationally, so we provide them with a stipend as well as tuition.
But, yeah, what about the medical school?
Yeah. Oh, the medical school, yes. But there's only 80 of them, so. But the medical school tuition, though, compared to private university, is still very affordable for Connecticut residents. And they do take out loans for those programs, and same thing for the law school. So for professional programs, it is different than traditional graduate programs.
If I could make a comment earlier to that idea of, you know, whether or not student loans affect student persistence, I think something to think about is that financial aid packages are given on an annual basis. So as a high school student, when I'm applying to college, I get my financial aid package, and I think about how can I make it work for this year. But then the next year, I may or may not get financial aid, and I don't know. And so I think that that's something to think about when we think about student persistence as well, or some of the structures that we have in place as a sector, and how that affects students, not just, you know, oh, are they taking on debt, but also how are we limiting their ability to think ahead and to plan ahead.
I'm sorry, I have another follow-up to that. On the community college graduation rate, and comparing it to financial indebtedness, which is very low, I have found over the years that community college students do not take out loans, and that's why they go part-time, because they're uncomfortable with that and they tend to go pay as you go. And if they have to take a semester off in order to get some more money to go back the following semester, they do it that way. My question is that different from state to state? Or is Connecticut typical of the community college students that they don't take out loans? Okay, so
I'd say that you'll see there's a lot of, I guess, studies and that sort of thing that talk about how low-income families are less likely to take out loans than middle-income families. And I think that that's something to think about, that loans, yes, it's an investment, and education is an investment, and I think it's, you know, part of the equation here to think about loans. But culturally, I think for certain parts of the population, loans are much more manageable in terms of understanding what they're about. Because, say, as a parent, I already have a mortgage, I already have a car payment, I know how to make those things work. Whereas for, I would say, you know, those from lower income backgrounds, it's definitely something that we've seen in the literature where they're less likely to take out loans.
In addition to that, community colleges have often been reticent to participate in the student federal loan program because if their default rate gets too high, it puts their entire Title IV participation at risk. And so it tends to be something that community colleges in general across the country do not actively promote students to take out loans, because if that default rate exceeds the federal allowable limit, then they will not be able to award Pell Grants.
In the gap in community colleges between tuition and fees versus Pell is much smaller?
A full Pell Grant is $5,550. Full tuition and fees of the community colleges is $3,780 plus books. So a full Pell Grant can cover the entire cost of tuition, fees, and books, but there's also living expenses to account for, and community colleges clearly don't have residence halls, but they have to live somewhere.
Obviously, we could go on for a long time, but I want to be respectful of people's time. We're closing in on the end of it. Clearly, there's a lot of interest and a lot of discussion to have. One of the things we do need to think about is our next meeting in terms of what we might want to bring forward. I mean, we'll have some report for you on where we are with the RFP response, but based on what you heard today, are there things that we ought to be bringing forward in terms of educating all of us?
As we're going forward and trying to change things, do we have could we have the information that we need for our baseline so that we know where we're moving from? I mean, there are a lot of things that we're talking about completion rates, we're talking about retention rates, we're talking about a variety of things. So if we know that there's a 76% completion rate at certain, we want to move to 85%, 90%. What are we going to be talking about? What are we measuring, and where are we starting from, and where are we moving to?
Well, part of the RFP actually asks the consultant to collect that data, but I do know, based on what we've heard today and others, we have a lot of resources in the room between Braden and UConn and Judy Griman at the Independence. We have a lot of data, so it may be helpful, but I do think that the consultant is being charged with amalgamating all that data to bring forward as we deliberate what do we want to do. So, I mean, if there's specific information that you want, I mean, I think we ought to think about that if it will help our discussions, but that will come from the consultant as well.
I want to follow up on that, Jude. I mean, part of it is setting goals, and that's what this committee will be charged with doing, is establishing where do we want to be in 2020? Where should we be in terms of completion? Looking at some of the issues that we've discussed today at the different institutions, whether it be community colleges, certificate programs. So we'll be looking at where Connecticut needs to be and what our goals should be and how we're going to get there. So, but obviously there's a lot of information out there for us to gather. And I want to thank Monica for coming down here today. I think you did a great job and certainly got us thinking in a lot of different directions. And it was a great place to start.
With that, thoughts for next meeting? Don't all ask a one. Well, we'll come up with that. I mean, we did have some suggestions from last time that in terms of some distance learning things as well that we may. I just wanted to take a look at August 13th would be our standing date. Is that good for people? We're good? Then it will be that, August 13th. Is there other business that we need to bring forward before the group? Anything else? Well, thank you all. It was a productive session. And thank you again, Monica. That was just delightful. And we're looking forward to some of that data you promised.